This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty, welcome to episode 41 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we are joined by ESPN analyst and Basketball Hall of Famer, Rebecca Lobo. Rebecca, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today. And of course, you have a podcast yourself with your husband and longtime sports writer, Steve Rushen, the Ball and Chain podcast. We'll give that a quick plug as well. But I do have to ask if it's true that you and your husband met when you confronted him for a sort of snarky remark that he wrote about the WNBA.
Well, first of all, I am impressed that our wall colors are exactly the same. But yes, you are absolutely correct. It's funny. I was playing with the New York Liberty and I was subletting an apartment from a guy named John Walters, who was writing at Sports Illustrated at the time. And I had been living there a couple of weeks and John said, you know, I'll come down. I'll kind of show you around the neighborhood. And so he did. We went to dinner and then we went to this dive bar on the Upper West Side, the Dublin House. And while we were there, John said, oh, a couple of my colleagues from Sports Illustrated are going to meet us out for a beer, Steve Rushen and Mark Beach. And I'd been reading Steve for years. And this is before, you know, they had like the little picture in the with the column as well. Yeah. So I had no idea like how old he was, what he looked like. I knew nothing about him. And in walks, you know, these two guys. And but I did know that and he hates that this happened, that he wrote this. But he had just written a column with a bunch of like different one liners. And one of them was, you know, Wilt Chamberlain bragged about sleeping with 10,000 women. The other night I slept with 6,000. I was at a New York Liberty game. And so like I'm probably one or two beers in and when I meet him and I said, are you the guy who wrote the thing about the WNBA in your column? And he just turned red and he said, yeah, that was me. And I said, well, how many WNBA games have you been to? How many Liberty games have you been to? Excuse me. And he said, none. And I said, well, obviously, because we get 14,000. So at least if you say you're going to be sleeping, it's with 14,000. I said, well, you're going to have to at some point come to New York Liberty game. So later that summer he did, and we didn't start dating until a couple months later. But yeah, that's one of our first interactions, and we've been challenging one another ever since. We've been married 21 years now. So yeah.
And how does he feel about the WNBA now?
He loves it. He loves women's basketball. And and at that time, and he's not that guy either. That's the part that's sort of interesting. He's not the guy who makes fun of women's sports just because. And since then, not only has he been to a bunch of WNBA games and college games, but we have three daughters. And so he has been to a bunch of youth basketball games from like age 7 up. We actually have our second oldest is a senior in high school, and her high school team is playing for the state championship this coming weekend. So we will be there invested, rooting like crazy, respecting like crazy.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he has certainly come around, and his number of WNBA games he's attended, I think we've both lost count, but it's no longer zero.
Yeah, no, it's a funny story. And then for anybody who thinks that they don't like women's basketball, I think your marriage is proof that anybody can quite literally fall in love with the sport. So
and athletes and writers can coincide too.
Yeah.
But it's funny because we have such a different like viewpoint of things. Like even early on when we were dating, one time, you know, Roger Clemens was on TV and I was like, oh, I love Roger. He's such a nice guy. And Steve looked at me, he goes, he once made me wait for like 2 days for an interview. And we just have like such different worldview or we did of like our interactions with different athletes.
How is your view now being on the media side for so long? How has your view changed of that athlete and media sort of relationship?
Well, I'm fortunate in that the athletes I cover are terrific to cover. I just cover women's college basketball, not just, but I cover women's college basketball in the WNBA, and the athletes give us great access, and there's a lot of respect back and forth. One thing I've certainly come to understand that I didn't back in the day when people were covering me, I was like, oh, you don't write the headlines. You just write the story, and then someone else chooses what to put for the headline. Or now if I'm, if somebody wants to interview me for something, I make sure to be on time because, there was a time when Steve was writing, I forget what it was about. And it was probably about 15 or 20 years ago. And he was waiting for a call from Michael Irvin. And he, for some reason, was a key piece to whatever story Steve was going to be writing and supposed to call at whatever point. And of course he didn't. But he had to I think this is back in when you had landlines. So he's tethered to the house waiting for this call to come. And I don't think he'd mind if I told this story. So at some point he has to go to the bathroom and he's sitting on the toilet. He just hears the phone ringing and by the time he gets there, it's gone to voicemail. And when he gets the voicemail, it's, "Hey, Steve Rushen, this is Michael Irvin. Michael Irvin calling for Steve Rushen. No callback number, nothing." So he never made it into the story, but I certainly have a respect for deadlines like I never used to, and for making sure I try to be on time with folks.
When did you become interested in media or start to view it at least as a potential career path?
Not until after college and right after college. And the reason for that is there weren't enough games being broadcast when I was still in college to think that it could be a way you could make a living. I was a political science major, not a communications major, thinking, all right, I'm going to go overseas and play basketball and make some money because I graduated from college in 95. The WNBA wasn't announced till 96. And then all of a sudden there was a boon. And right out of college, I got a chance to work in studio for ESPN for a couple of years during the tournament with Robin Roberts and Mimi Griffin. And I was terrible because I didn't know how to do this job. And it was a lot harder those days because you couldn't just get online and find all the information you needed. That's back when you did fax back. You would have to dial a number and then get 30 pages of game notes on your fax machine. But it was then as women's basketball grew and more games were on TV, I was like, this is awesome. I didn't really want to coach, but I love being around the game. And now I've been able to do it for the past 25 years, whatever it's been. So I guess 20 years. So it's been great.
Throughout your career in the media and as a player, did you ever envision a time where top women's college basketball games would be getting as much attention and ratings as some of the top men's college basketball games?
It's blown me away. This year in particular has blown me away. When you see multiple times women's college basketball game, and let's be honest, a Caitlin Clark Iowa game has outrated a NBA game that they're going to head to head with. That's been incredible. And we even saw, the ratings for this past Sunday, Champ Sunday. And of course, the Big Ten got the biggest rating, but even, the SEC championship and the ACC championship, all of those ratings in women's basketball are skyrocketing. And it's kind of fun to be a part of this because, we've been doing it, for those of us who have been doing it for a long time, we've known that the product is really, really good. And I felt this way the last couple of years in the WNBA in particular. We're at the tipping point. You're just waiting for whatever it was going to be to push it over the edge. And that thing has ended up being Caitlin Clark in Iowa. But the product on the court has been at a really high level, both in college, but in particular in the WNBA for the last 5 to 10 years. So now that people are watching, it's like, okay, great. Because when they tune in, they're not going to be disappointed because the play is at such a high level right now.
How important has Caitlin Clark been to the growth of women's college basketball? Or is it even possible that her importance is overstated because it is the sport that's growing and it's not just one individual?
I don't think her importance is overstated. I think she's a singular force like we've never seen before in the women's game, in particular in the women's college game. And we've had great players. We just haven't had this mix of a player who does something we've never seen before in the women's college game in terms of the logo threes. Every time the stakes raise and it feels like, oh, geez, there's got to be a lot of pressure on this kid, a lot of pressure. She meets the moment. And she does so many other things that are so exciting. Like I, my favorite part of her game is her passing. She is an incredible passer, and dynamic and has the right personality and all of that. But, and yes, the rest of the women's game is incredible. Like I can't wait till this summer when hopefully the ratings translate to a degree to the WNBA, because people I think who haven't watched it before are really going to be kind of blown away at the level that these women play at. And yes, and it's there in college too. And we've seen, I think Doug Feinberg from the AP was the one who kind of wrote, you know, there have been ticket selling teams where because of what's written on the front of the jersey, whether it's UConn or Tennessee or South Carolina, have sold tickets on the road. But this is the first time, as he phrased it, that it's been the name on the back of the jersey that's really driven ticket sales and eyeballs on the game. So she's been a singular force and has come along right at the perfect moment.
Has her impact on college basketball changed at all the way the WNBA has played?
I don't think so. You know, what's interesting is like we have Sabrina Ionescu, we've had Diana Taurasi for years who have range out to, you know, 25 feet. But we haven't ever had a player like Caitlin who comes down and consistently just takes 25 to 30 footers. Like it's just part of her game and does it at a pretty high percentage. And so what I think you're going to see the effect is down the road. You know, are we going to see more girls and women's players who try to extend their range? Who, or are we going to see more coaches, frankly? Like Lisa Bluter, the Iowa coach, doesn't get enough credit for allowing Caitlin to play that way when she first got there. I mean, think, you know, if you're coaching a team and a kid's coming down and taking these logo bombs, I would imagine most coaches would try to rein that in a little bit. Yeah. She's let her, at least Coach Bluter has let Caitlin be herself and flourish. And so, yeah, I think we'll see. I don't know how long it will take. You know, I guess it's kind of like the Steph Curry impact in the NBA and college, but I think we'll start seeing more women try to play that way and maybe more coaches allow them to play that way.
What did you think of the Jay Williams take a few weeks ago that Caitlin Clark can't be considered great without winning a championship?
I mean, of course she's a great player. Of course she's the great player. And I think Jay Billis had the best retort to that. He said, you know, if you want to talk about whether or not she's the greatest, that's one conversation. Yeah. But of course she's a great player. And we do have women in the women's game. You know, Brianna Stewart won 4 national championships, 4-time most outstanding performer at the Final Four. Diana Taurasi, Candace Parker with multiple college championships. So, you know, I think, of course she's a great player. It's silly to say otherwise. Although I know what Jay Will, I think, was thinking as he was formulating that, you know, I'm not going to consider you part of the greatest conversation until you win a championship. But of course, Caitlin was one game away from that last year. You know, when they played LSU, a team that averaged under 5, made 3s per game and then made 9 in the first half. Like LSU was otherworldly in the championship game. So, you know, she was pretty darn close a year ago. And so we'll have to wait and see what happens as well.
Yeah, certainly capable of giving a championship worthy performance. And I don't necessarily want to just give Jay an out because he kept saying great on that broadcast, but I do all similarly wonder if he kind of meant greatest of all time and just, I don't know, maybe got caught up in the moment a little bit and said great and stuck with it. And it kind of backfired a bit. Have you spoken to Jay about that comment at all?
No, I haven't seen Jay. I typically run into him in the studio, but I haven't had a chance to talk to him about
it. Was there ever a time that you got caught up in a take or an opinion and said something maybe that you gave analysis or said something that you maybe regretted on air?
Fortunately, as you asked that question, nothing immediately comes to mind. And I've learned, actually, this is an area that being married to Steve has been impactful. And I've learned how important words are and your choice of words are. And so I, especially when I'm in studio and have a little bit more time to like formulate thoughts, I'm really particular about my words. And even when I've talked about Caitlin, you know, being the best, because I think she's the best offensive player I've ever seen. But I'll couch that in the last 30 years because I didn't see Cheryl Miller play in person person. I didn't see Ann Myers Drysdale. I didn't see Carol Blazejowski or Nancy Lieberman, and that's my loss. But I think it's important sometimes to be kind of really specific in your area of expertise and trying to say things that you should. But I'm sure if I watched stuff from, you know, early in my career, there'd be a lot of things that I would say, what were you thinking about? But nothing that comes to mind as, man, that was a boneheaded thing to say.
Yeah. I'll preface this by saying, I don't think this is a moment where you got caught up in the moment or anything like that and said something regrettable, but do you remember
are you coming back at me with something regrettable?
No, I don't, this is not regrettable. I am curious, cause I thought this was one of your more, well-known comments in 2016 during a broadcast, calling Maya Moore, such a nasty woman. And I will reiterate that the importance of the year, that being 2016, and that was the next question, was that intentional, coming right immediately after the Donald Trump Hillary Clinton debate when he said such a nasty woman.
So we were in Minnesota. Was it a playoff game or a regular season game? I don't remember.
I think it might have been a playoff game.
Playoff game. So we're in Minnesota and we were watching the debates. I was probably with Ruco and Holly Rowe watching the debates. And you know, Hillary Clinton's called a nasty woman or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Yes. So it was intentional. And so we were, of course, talking about it that night. And sometimes you have those things happen where you're with your colleagues and you're talking about a certain something, and then your challenge to yourself is to get it into the next broadcast. Not something to this degree where other people have any idea what you're talking about, but it's just kind of a way that, you know, you're rolling a break, and then Ryan and I will like give each other a fist bump because we're able to get something in that makes us laugh. But yes, 100% that was intentional. And you know, I would say that again.
Yeah, and I think it hit perfectly. On the topic of presidents, how cool was it getting to fill out a bracket with Barack Obama?
So amazing. So the first year that he filled out his men's bracket, they didn't do a women's bracket. And I think some blowback came from that. And I think the first bracket he filled out on the women's side was with Doris Burke. And then I got to do it for a couple years with him. And it was awesome because you go in and, you know, they're setting up this whole room. I think both times we were in the map room when we did this. And Andy Katz would do the men's bracket with him first. And then it would be my chance to fill it out. And President Obama, at least one of the times, said to me, he's like, Rebecca, all right, I don't follow the women's game quite as closely as I would like to because I'm the president and I don't have time, basically was implied. He said, so like, kind of help me through this. So he had filled out the bracket, and then he would say who's advancing. And then, you know, it's my turn to throw in the nugget or something about that team. But man, he was just a cool, cool dude. And I love the fact that he was a ball player because, you know, ball players tend to be cool people.
Had you been to the White House before that?
I actually had been to the White House. I went to the White House a couple of times when Bill Clinton was the president. So our 95 team at UConn wins the national championship. And so when you win the national championship, you know, you go to the White House, and the team went, but I missed it because I was trying out for the national team, the Olympic team. I was out in Colorado Springs. And so I got invited later in the summer to go, and I jogged with President Clinton, got to go to the Oval Office. There was a couple of us. He kind of gave us like a personal tour. And then George Bush invited Steve to the Oval Office because Steve had been down there to interview him about sports and baseball and all these other things. And so Steve and I got to go to a Christmas party and then went to the White House, were invited with Barack Obama to fill out the bracket. So, and then that's where my visits ended. I have not been to the White House since.
What was the experience of, this is obviously in Olympic year, what was the experience of playing in the 96 Olympics like?
It was incredible. And first of all, it was different from what it is now because they didn't win gold in 1992. So it wasn't just train a few times a year and let's go go win the gold. We were together. That national team was put together in 1995, and we trained for just about a year together, traveled all over the world, traveled all over the country. It was kind of one of the barnstorming things that helped put a lot of eyeballs on the WNBA, because we played all over. We would stay and sign autographs. We would do all of these appearances because they had already announced that the WNBA was starting in 97. So it was kind of 96. You know, we're raising awareness of what women's pro basketball could be in the U.S. And then for the Olympics to be in Atlanta, to be in our home country, and to win the gold, it was incredible. But a lot of it, the payoff was of a year of grueling, like playing in Siberia in February, playing in China in the middle of the winter. Like, we went to some hard, tough places to play hard, tough teams. And so it was a great way to end that run.
What was the excitement level at that point about just knowing that the WNBA was coming and you were going to be part of that inaugural season?
Yeah, it was huge, but there was a lot of unknowns. It's funny because if you ever see any pictures of like me and Lisa and Cheryl, Lisa Leslie and Cheryl Swoops, because, you know, for a while, it was just the three of us that were like known signed entities to the league, because a lot of the other Olympians had gone to play in the ABL, which started in the fall, and we didn't start until the summer. But we're wearing like WNBA logoed stuff in pictures, and it's because there weren't the New York Liberty didn't have a logo yet, and the Houston Comets didn't have a logo yet. So it was all this like brand new stuff going on. But it was incredibly exciting for all of us because we knew that there had been many pro leagues that had tried and failed for women's basketball in the U.S. But all of us kind of knew, well, if David Stern's behind this and the NBA is behind this, this one really has a chance. So it was a really, really exciting time to be involved sort of in the birth of the league.
There was a confidence level, though, that this iteration of professional basketball for women was gonna last. Like, you saw the WNBA, did you envision it being here, you know, 25, 30 years later at that point?
You know, I was 22 years old, so I couldn't have envisioned anything. You know, you're wrapped up in whatever's happening the next day in your 23-year-old life. And, but I think all of us had a confidence, you know, when you spend time around David Stern, you feel like this guy doesn't let things fail. And so that was the feeling I got about the WNBA, was with this guy behind it, and he's kind of going out on a limb by, you know, getting his owners behind this league. We're going to at least get a number of years out of this to see if it can really work.
Yeah. It was only a couple of years ago that women's college basketball was granted use of the March Madness trademark. And I think there were a few other things that, were made implemented to make women's basketball a little bit more equal to men's. Like, I think the women just recently started getting the same tournament gifts even as the men do. Do you think changes like that directly correlate at all to the women's game growing in popularity?
I do. And it's interesting too, that the right thing, people don't just do the right thing. People sometimes are forced to do the right thing. It's like Title IX. Well, of course, it's always been the right thing to support women's athletics and treat females equitably in the collegiate atmosphere. But it wasn't until Title IX and the enforcement of it that actually happened. It wasn't until the bubble in 2021 when Sedona Prince, you know, is kind of showing videos of the discrepancy between how the women were treated and the men, that change happened. I think it's really important, not only for the women to feel valued at the same level, but for the NCAA to say, we do value you. And of course, it was good timing for the NCAA to say, we value you, because guess what? It's a really valuable product right now.
Yeah.
But absolutely, I think that was really important. And you know, in the WNBA is lucky, you know, Kathy Engelbert is an outstanding commissioner, and she has made changes since she arrived in 2019, 2020. And I think the league right now is in a really good position to take advantage of all of the things that this rookie class is going to help, is going to do to help really buoy the league. I think they're in a really good position as well. So the timing has obviously too late. It would have been nice if those things that happened in 2021 in terms of the NCAA tournament had happened sooner, but at least they happened. And now the women's game is going to benefit from them.
How big was it getting the tournament championship put on ABC last year for the first time?
We got 10 million people. It was huge. And you know, it's maybe some point we'll get it in prime time. I don't know how much that would increase ratings or if it would at all. But I mean, even this year, when you look at the ratings, and a lot of Iowa's games mostly are not on ESPN because we don't have the Big Ten contract, but CBS is, they're getting 3 million for the Big Ten championship game. Would you get that if you are not on a network? So it makes a huge impact. We've seen it because we do a lot of WNBA games now on ABC. We do more college women's games on ABC than we ever have over the course of, say, the last 2 or 3 years. And you're always going to rate better on ABC than you do on ESPN or ESPN2 or whatever. It's just a matter of fact. And so, yes, that was another area where we were fortunate because last year's Final Four was phenomenal. You had the great story of South Carolina being undefeated, Caitlin Clark, of course, LSU, all of the stories were there. And fortunately, it was on ABC. And so we got the results of the highest viewed game ever.
Is it frustrating? Like, does it seem like women's college basketball and the WNBA are constantly having to prove that they're worthy of bigger platforms as opposed to just kind of like getting the opportunity to be on a bigger platform to help grow the game?
It's not frustrating anymore because I think we really get those platforms, you know, whether it was 5 or 6 years ago or maybe longer ago than that, probably closer to 10 years ago. I can remember, you know, there were the epic WNBA playoffs between like Phoenix and Minnesota. And this is, you know, Diana Taurasi going against a Minnesota team that ended up winning four championships. And like the first, we would have games 1 and 2 of a 3-game series. And then game 3 would be on NBA TV or something because we didn't have the WNBA window. That was incredibly frustrating. That's not the case anymore. You know, ESPN can cover all of the playoff games. So it has certainly grown. Were there times when it was frustrating? Absolutely. But we're in a place now, I think, where it's no longer frustrating. You're kind of sitting back and saying, yes, everybody is seeing what we've known for so long and how great this sport can be.
Does NIL help grow the WNBA in that, like, the league is now starting to get athletes who are more well-known because they had brand endorsements in college?
Well, it's interesting because athletes, women's basketball players have tended to be better known in college just because more people watch women's college basketball. And then so one of the frustrating pieces could be, all right, they get to the WNBA and their profile might decrease a little bit just because of the difference in ratings. Where NIL really helps is now you're going to have players who we see in Gatorade commercials or in Nike commercials or whatever the case may be throughout college. And those endorsements, those commercials, that kind of thing is going to continue in the WNBA. So I certainly hope and think it will help keep their profile at a certain level versus in the past where sometimes it might decrease because you're going from, you know, playing a bunch of games on national TV because you're, you know, with an undefeated UConn team, and then you go to the WNBA and there might not be as much attention on the sport. I feel like now it's going to be more equitable.
Are you a fan of NIL in college sports?
You know, I was actually having this conversation last night with somebody in studio. And while I would have benefited from NIL, in particular my senior year, I'm glad that I'm not playing in this era of social media because I think it's so, so hard for these young people to kind of navigate all the criticism that can constantly be at their fingertips. But in terms of NIL, you know, athletes have been getting a lot of money for their universities for a long time and certainly should be benefiting themselves financially. I don't know if, you know, if that's what exactly is the best model or if we're ever going to be at a place where we get to the best model. But the trade-off is certainly can be a hard one, you know, just in terms of you have to be on social media because that's where you're going to make a lot of your money by posting. But then at the same time, if you go into your mentions, you know, you're getting gut punched to every third one. So it's an interesting time, that's for sure.
And what about college coaches sort of expressing their disdain for NIL and college athletes getting paid. I think even Gino Auriemma had went on a bit of a rant a couple months ago about it. Just in terms of kind of it is a strange dynamic when you have college coaches who are making a lot of money and then they are questioning the athlete's drive to still win and perform now that they're starting to get some money.
Well, I think Gino's thing was more about how you know, recruiting players now is more of a transactional thing versus a relationship building thing. And I think certain coaches, that's the biggest piece for them is getting to know somebody and then helping them grow throughout their 4 years. And I don't know that it's so much an NIL issue as it is a portal issue where kids can just transfer and now potentially transfer multiple times without any repercussions. And, oh, things are hard or I don't play as much as I would like to, so I'm going to go to a different school. I think that's the bigger issue, at least that has been expressed to me when I've been calling college games, is the frustration with how quickly kids can kind of quit or give up on a particular situation and move elsewhere than there is on the NIL. I have heard some conversation about, you know, with coaches saying, you know, you're recruiting a kid and again, instead they might really like you and want to play for you, but another school can, you know, has more NIL opportunities for them. And so there's that frustrating piece. But I think ultimately most of the coaches we talk to, they really miss the 4 years that they would get with kids and building relationships through recruiting and helping kids get through hard times, especially in their first couple of years in college. So, you know, to help them grow and reach their potential. And it's hard to do that now because it's so easy when things get tough to just move on.
What did you think of the South Carolina LSU fight last weekend and Kim Mulkey's response to the incident?
The brouhaha, as one of my friend's moms called it. It was unfortunate, of course. You never want to see things escalate to that level. It was a really physical game, and I think this is a tough dance for officials to do in that you don't want to tag star players with early fouls. You want to let the game be to a degree physical, but at the same time, you can't let it get out of hand because as players, you know, all right, you just cheap shotted me and nothing was called. All right, when we go down the other end, I'm gonna get you too. And I think we got to that point, and it was certainly an unfortunate thing that happened. I do like that there are real kind of rivalries involved in women's basketball. Like back in my era, because like, well, there wasn't texting, but even if I played with somebody on a USA basketball team, like when I went back to UConn, I wasn't like texting them. We weren't friends. And then when we would meet up with each other, like every team we played, we wanted to beat, and every team we played, we didn't like. And I can remember maybe 6 or 7 years ago, Gino Auriemma said, like, where's all the hate? Where did the hate go? Because in some ways that fuels fun, exciting basketball.
And for sure.
So I like that the South Carolina LSU rivalry is heated. I like that these teams don't love one another. Of course, didn't like how it escalated. And I liked what Kim Mulkey said in terms of, you know, only two fouls being called, one on each team in the fourth quarter. And she said, you know, we foul the heck out of you. They foul the heck out of you. Like the more fouls should have been called. In terms of the thing about, you know, you should have pushed Angel Reese or whatever the quote was. That probably wasn't my favorite thing that was said in the post-game presser.
Is there added excitement as a broadcaster when you're calling championship games? Like, is there a different energy on that broadcast?
There's a different energy when you're calling championship games for sure. And there's always a different energy when you're calling good games. And our crew talks about this a lot. After games, you're like, especially after a bad game, you recognize that you're at the mercy of the game. Like you can have a good call, but you're not going to have a great call on a turd of a game. Yeah. But when a game is great and your juices are flowing, there's a different energy. And of course, when that also is a conference championship or an Elite Eight game or a Final Four game, and we've been really lucky over the course of the last couple of years because we had a couple great semifinals last year, a great final the year before. We had an incredible Elite Eight game when UConn had the overtime win over NC State. Like, we've had some really great moments where the basketball is at a really high level and your energy's up and you feel good about how you've kind of called the game.
How do you prepare for the tournament, especially when you're doing studio work as well? Like, are you studying the entire field, or are you more just watching it and reacting to the games as they come?
It's really hard. The first weekend of the tournament, I think, is the hardest weekend of the year in studio. But fortunately for me, I'm in studio all year long. So every week I'm preparing. And because when you're in studio, you're not just talking about halftime of the game that you're watching. You're talking about every game that is being played that day by a top 25 team. So there's a ton of prep that goes into the months leading into it. The first couple weekends are hard because there's a lot of teams that you might not have been covering as closely because they're not in the top 25, or maybe they were their surprise winner of their conference. And so, you know, when I used to work with Kara Lawson and then Coach Landers and now with Andrea Carter, we kind of split the teams as we go in. All right, these are our matchups. I'm going to focus. You focus on these. I'll focus on these. And then we can kind of really study the way we need to. But between Sunday and Friday, Selection Sunday in the first round, because we won't work the first four, the first round, Thursday or Friday, whenever that is. I mean, it's just constant prep. And a lot of it's refreshing your memory because you've been prepping all year, but there's a lot that's new as well.
I know you mentioned earlier that you get good access to WNBA players, but what is the relationship between WNBA players and the media like? Does the league, players, teams, are they good about giving reporters access and the access needed to kind of, I don't know, help promote the sport?
It's interesting because media is so broad now, right? Like, I feel the TV media, our crews at ESPN, I feel like we have a great relationship with the players and the coaches. We get incredible access from the coaches. They're always going to talk to us before games, either after their shoot around or if they're not shooting around that day, they'll talk to us that morning. Players or give us great access. And one of the things that's been interesting covering the WNBA for a lot of years is in terms of television, WNBA has often been like the test balloon. We were the first ones to do coach interviews, at the end of the first and third quarter, and that went pretty well. And then the NBA did it. First ones to have players mic'd during the game, and then they'd come in with the wired sound. So over the years, it's been like, let's try it on the WNBA, see what it's like. There was one year where we had the ref cam. And it was the ref would be open like they are in the NFL to the arena to okay. kind of say what the thing is. Now they just talk right into the TV. But for right. 1 year, they could talk to the arena. It didn't go. It wasn't executed well. So that lasted 1 year and that never made it to the NBA. But the access is great. The thing that can be hard, and I know there was some frustration voiced by WNBA players in particular during the finals, I think limited access after games, is that there's a lot of people who get credentials now who, it's a different landscape where, you know, they might be asking for an autograph or a picture or, okay. or things that are different from kind of how we've all grown up as media people of what's appropriate and not. So I think there's been some pushback from players, but we haven't felt it. I think there's been some pushback in other areas.
Are there enough reporters who are there every day so that those relationships are kind of built between the players and the press so that then when it does come time for an all-star game or the finals or a big event like that, that there is that kind of trust and relationship between the reporters and players?
I think so. The hard thing is when like a locker room, like this year the WNBA changed it where post game, and this was at the request of the players and the Players Association, that media can't go in to the locker room after a game. However, if you request a player, they come out and, you know, talk to you in the hallway or whatever the case may be. What's been a huge growth point that I have seen throughout my time covering the WNBA, and I started covering it the season after I retired, so 2004, so it's 20 years now, is, you know, one of the great resources for us as we're getting ready to call a game is to read the local news coverage of a team. And 20 years ago, like the LA Times or the LA papers, they weren't writing about the Sparks. Like you couldn't find anything. You could always find stuff with the Connecticut Sun. They had Minnesota links. There were certain places where their local print outlets were covering them regularly, but there were others where they weren't. Now there's as much information as you can possibly find because you don't need space column inches anymore in a newspaper. You can do stuff online. You can do blogs. You can do, there's so much more information now and so much more access and so many more people covering the teams and the players. And as a result, to get back to your question, yes, relationships are built and you know, of course you're going to get the best stuff when you're somebody who's been at a lot of practice and at every game and you've kind of built the relationship with the local player for your team.
Does the WNBA or did the WNBA, does it still get unfairly judged because it's compared to the NBA?
I don't think by those who matter. You know, like there's always going to be the subset on social media in particular that's, you know, go back to the kitchen, make me a sandwich. But to me, who cares about those folks? I think especially now, you know, the WNBA or women's basketball right now is hot. It's a commodity. I think, you know, this summer in particular, people are going to be like, ooh, I want to give Caitlin Clark, I want to give this a chance. Let me see what this is like. Because, I mean, when's the last time we had this many stars in women's college basketball who were this much more well-known than men's stars in men's college basketball? Yeah. Like, it's a crazy and super exciting time. And I don't, like, you don't really have the lower the rim, they don't dunk anymore. Like, who cares? I mean, I'm sure you do, but not by people whose voices really matter.
Yeah. What did you think about the Steph Curry, Sabrina Ionescu competing in a 3-point contest at the All-Star game? What'd you think of that event?
I thought it was so great. And Sabrina performed incredibly well. Steph was like the perfect guy to do it too, because he's been supporting women's basketball for a long time. I called a game when Sabrina was with Oregon and they played at Stanford, and it was the same day as Kobe's funeral. And Sabrina had spoken at Kobe's funeral, flown up to the game and had a triple double. And I believe Steph Curry was there. Like, they've had a relationship. He's a supporter of the women's game. So it was kind of a perfect way to go about it. It was very different from like the Bobby Riggs, Billie Jean King thing. Like, you know, he was helping to try to grow the game. So I would love to see them do it again. I'm kind of hopeful that maybe they'll have a rematch at the WNBA All-Star game this summer. But I thought it was terrific. And it was, I think, the highest rated portion of Saturday night at All-Star, which doesn't surprise me because it's the kind of thing people, and I think most people who were tuning in weren't like, you know, man versus woman. I think most people were tuning in just like, oh, this is going to be really cool. What's it going to look like? Is she going to, you know, make all but two shots again off of the ball rack? So it was the right vibe and the right people at the right time.
Yeah, no, I think people were tuning in because it was two great shooters competing against each other, and it certainly lived up to that. How is working with Ryan Rucco? This is going to be your fourth college championship game, I think, on the call with Ryan, and then you've done 11 WNBA finals with him now, I believe. How is that dynamic?
I love working with Ryan Rucco. I absolutely love it. When I sit down next to him to call a game, I know I can be my best. He is such a phenomenal play-by-play guy. I feel like we know one another's rhythm perfectly. We have similar senses of humor. So, and like, I know he's so good with big calls and big moments. And I know, I think really well how to give him the room to do that. But I absolutely love working with Ryan, and, you know, have never had a moment in, I mean, 11 years is a long time, especially in when you're working the WNBA together and you might be, you know, working a playoff series. And if it's a Remy and your producers and everybody are back in Bristol, you're the only two on the road, or if Holly Rowe's with us. And we just, you know, back in the day, we used to go for runs in the morning before we'd call the game, you know, eat our meals together. We just have a great relationship that I hope translates into our call.
Is that something that you try to be conscious of as an analyst and not stepping on the call, like trying to take note of when there's a potential for a big moment and to give the play-by-play voice that space?
I think it's one of the things I'm most conscious of during a game. And there are certain games, of course, like a Caitlin Clark game. If she's coming down the floor, even if I'm in mid thought, sometimes I'll just stop because if she's going to launch a bomb, Ryan needs to make that call. But like, it's something I learned from Doris Burke. I can remember, I think it was the year that Mississippi State upset UConn in the national semifinal. Morgan Williams hits this shot. UConn's has their 100 and however many game winning streak and hits the shot. And I just remember that, you know, they had the camera on the announcers and Doris Burke just sitting back and like doing this with her hands, like, let the game breathe. Let's not say anything. And I think she's incredible at that. And I think that's super, super important, is to give the play-by-play person their room to make their call, because especially now in the day of social media where everything's clipped off and posted, right. I take great pride. Like sometimes there might be a reel from a game we've done. And if you don't hear me once, I'll text Ryan and be like, yes, like, cause if it's a big moment and there's a big call, I shouldn't be ending my story. I shouldn't be droning on. That's his moment. And, so I do. I take pride in that, and hopefully, I'm good at that.
Is there an added appreciation for Ryan in that, like, you know, when he started with the WNBA, he was a rising star in this business, and now he is a star play-by-play voice, and yet he's still, you know, he didn't use the WNBA as a stepping stone. Like he saw the growth potential there, and he has grown with the league. Now he's a star calling NBA games as well, but still really seems to prioritize the WNBA.
He's a huge WNBA fan, and I think he takes great pride in how he's been the voice as the game has grown. And, you know, he was, 24, 25 years old when he first started with us. And I'd been working with Terry Gannon for a few years, who's phenomenal play-by-play, and I'm like, who's this young dude they're sending with us? And it was pretty quickly I learned, wow, this is because he's boy wonder. This kid is really, really good and invested and cares about women's basketball. And it was evident early on too that he wasn't just trying to use this as a way to get to the next step. And he is invested in the WNBA. You know, he's one of the producers on Sue Bird's documentary that is out now. Like he's invested in women's basketball. And so, yeah, I was thrilled for him when he got the number two announced position for the NBA, but it was kind of quickly said to him, you know, you can keep doing both. Even if you end up calling the NBA finals, you know, the seasons are such, you can keep doing both. So, super proud of him because I've been along on the ride with him as he's continued to grow. But he has been he's been great for the women's game, and you know, he'll say, like, you know, play by play is the soundtrack of the game, and I can't think of anybody better as women's basketball has grown to have their main soundtrack voice be.
And you mentioned getting to work with Doris Burke a little bit. How was that experience? And then now just getting to see her be part of the top booth in the NBA, and she'll be an analyst on the NBA finals this season.
You know, when I first started, right after I retired, my last season in the WNBA was 2003. So 2004 was my first year working the WNBA as a sideline reporter. And I was really, really fortunate that most of the games I worked, Doris was the analyst. And one of the reasons I was fortunate was they hired me to be a sideline reporter, but no one told me what that meant or what to do. They basically just told me how to book my flight. So I can remember my first game being a Washington Mystics game. And I just said to Doris, like, what do I do? We're going to shoot around. She said, okay. She said, talk to some players, like get some stories during timeouts, get in the huddle And then I was added as a sideline reporter the following college season to their big Monday game. Again, Doris was the analyst. Mark Jones was play-by-play. And I just got to learn, and she would kind of take me under her wing. And I used to like write out my whole report on an index card. And she said, you know, go with bullet points, and taught me like the mechanics of it.
Yeah.
But what also I was really lucky was, because I was working those games, I was listening to Doris call games, listening. I'm like, man, she says a lot with very few words. She is super insightful. Like, I kind of learned, you know, by listening to her, what is so good. And I'm thrilled for her now, because talk about somebody who's paid her dues, you know, all the years doing regional games, coming along, and then the woman who's kind of taken the brunt of criticism on a man's sport for all of us, you know, especially as social media, you know, was starting to explode. And, you know, she's taken a lot for the rest of us at a time when it was like, kind of okay to criticize a woman just for being a woman. She's the one who took all of that. And so I'm thrilled for her that she has this opportunity, and she's going to nail it like she does everything else. But she's earned it not only by what she's done as a commentator, but honestly, the assault she has taken for being a woman working on a man's sport. I don't think anybody else, at least kind of my age, can really understand what that was like.
Are you interested in calling NBA games? Is that something that you've done at all?
Last year I worked a little bit with Yes Network in studio, and I really enjoyed that. It's interesting because of course it's like a new challenge, and it was a lot of fun, but at the same time, like I don't think you need to call men's sports to, I don't even know how to articulate it. Like I love being the voice of the WNBA finals. I love calling the women's national championship game. And I don't think I need to aspire to do men's sports for any other reason than like last year. I just wanted the challenge to see if I could do it. And especially I have four kids. My oldest is in college. My youngest is now 13, but I was doing this all while they were young. And I can remember distinctly going in and meeting with folks at ESPN, like when my contract was up, and would say to them, don't take this as a lack of ambition, that I'm not pushing to do men's college games, or that I'm not pushing to do NBA. For my life to be really good at my job and to hopefully be really good as a mom and a wife, these are the two sports that I am totally passionate about and that I want to do. And I still feel that way. You know, next year, if ESPN said, you know, we have some NBA games, would you be interested in doing them? Of course I would say yes, but I'm not like pushing to do NBA. I am completely at peace and happy with the games that I get to call now.
Yeah. And I do think there's absolutely something to be said for, wanting to stick with women's college basketball and the WNBA for so long. And I think now that you and Ryan have been working together for so long, like when Ryan Rucco and Rebecca Lobo are on a broadcast together, it automatically feels like a big game. And I think that's a testament to you guys for staying together and sticking with women's basketball, as opposed to only aspiring to get to the NBA or anything like that.
Well, I appreciate that. And that's what we want it to feel like. And it's cool too now, because, you know, like you said, Ryan and I worked for a long time on the WNBA before he was, you know, came over to the college side. And it's cool because sometimes you do a college game and maybe it's a team that you haven't done a lot in the past. And sometimes players will come over and like, because they listen to you on WNBA games. And we had that a couple of years ago, and a player came over. She was excited to talk to us because she listened to WNBA games. And so I think it also, hopefully the current college players and WNBA players, you know, hopefully we do them justice and they feel that that's the case.
And what about coaching at the college or pro level? I know you mentioned earlier in your career that you knew you didn't want to coach. Is that the same feeling today?
I actually, I am a coach, and for kids in second grade through eighth grade. When my oldest was in second grade, her school had a team, and so I started coaching like youth basketball. And this year, my youngest, my fourth, is in eighth grade, and so her season just ended. And there's a guy I coach with, and he and I were saying this is, it was our 13th straight year coaching elementary through middle school kids, and now we're done. And it was awesome, and that's kind of what I'm built for. College coaching, no. WNBA, no. I love this job too much, and like there's just that one's just too hard. But I've been able to coach for the last 13 years. It just has been like little kids, and I tell you what, there's nothing quite like when you see like a third or fourth grader score her first basket and in the middle of a game, like jump into one of her teammates' arms because she's just so elated. Doesn't matter what the score is, like she's used every one of her 45, 60 pounds to get that ball through the basket. And some of my best memories are always going to be of just coaching little kids.
That's awesome. Rebecca, you were great. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That is Rebecca Lobo. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing Podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.